TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Our Renewable Future, Richard Heinberg. On a cool November Sunday, the hall of the Little Lake Grange in Willits, California, filled with members and supporters of WELL, Willits Economic Localization. 11 years earlier, many of them had come to hear Richard Heinberg after reading his book, The Party's Over, Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies. The 2004 Canadian documentary, The End of Suburbia, featured an interview with Heinberg, and it became an inspiration here as well as for the emerging international transition town movement. Arguing that modern life as we know it will end as easy oil reserves begin running out and climate change does not allow us to burn the rest, the transition town movement focuses on the interrelated issues of energy and economy, and also all the positive projects of local self-reliance that are already underway. Richard Heinberg's talk on Our Renewable Future is set among the frightening news about accelerating climate change. However, his message is serious but positive. He asks how our daily life will change as we fully embrace the era of renewable energy. How will we need to shift the ways we use energy, offering both opportunities and challenges? This ongoing community discussion came full circle for Willits Economic Localization, since Richard was one of their first inspirational speakers shortly after they formed in 2004. Here is Richard Heinberg.
How many were actually here? Quite a lot of you. Well, I'll try not to repeat myself too much. I'm sure it all had to do with energy. And the reason for that is that energy is really everything, and we take it so much for granted, but energy is what enables us to do all the things that we do as human beings. Without energy, we could literally do nothing. And we have used energy in different forms throughout our existence as a species. For the vast majority of that existence as a species, we used energy in renewable forms, whether through food that we hunted and gathered, or food crops that we grew, or firewood. And we exerted energy into our environment to change it, to get what we wanted and needed, by way of muscle power, either human muscles or animal muscles. Through much of our history as a nation, we actually had a horrific institution of slavery, which was all about capturing intelligently directed muscle power. And that required an epic war to bring that practice to an end. But during that century, the 19th century, we also made a historic switch from relying primarily on firewood and muscle power to relying on fossil fuels. And that shift from renewable energy to fossil fuels was absolutely epic. It changed everything about our economy, about the way we lived. You know, you've probably had the experience of running out of gas in your car and having to push your car off to the side of the road. That was a lot of work, right? Well, now imagine pushing your car 20 or 30 miles. How much work would that be? Well, obviously that would be a heck of a lot of work, something like 6 or 8 weeks of hard labor. But we get that done for us with a single gallon of gasoline for which we're paying $2.50 or in change, whatever. So imagine how cheap that energy is in comparison with muscle power. You know, if you could get somebody to work for you for 6 or 8 weeks hard labor for $2.50, imagine how much you could get done. This is why and how we have mechanized just about every economic process we possibly could over the course of the last 150, 200 years. And it has given us enormous economic advantages. We, instead of having, you know, literal human slaves, now we all have energy slaves. The average person has 100, 200, 300 energy slaves doing all the things for them that otherwise might be done by muscle power, whether it's moving them around or heating them or making their food or communication, what have you. Obviously, we're doing a lot of things that we weren't doing before, just because, you know, it would have been absurd to try to do it without these energy slaves. Now, there are a couple of problems with this story of advancement and success based on fossil fuels. One of them is the fact that burning all of these fossil fuels is creating a nightmare. And we're only seeing the very beginning of that nightmare right now, which of course is climate change. And this is not a climate change lecture per se, but if you haven't been to a climate change lecture or you haven't read a good book about it, you certainly should, because this is the most important thing that's going on in our lifetimes. And again, we're only seeing the tip of the melting iceberg, the rapidly melting iceberg in this regard. It's going to change just about everything about our world over the course of the next few decades. We have to move off of fossil fuels because of the absolutely apocalyptic consequences of continuing to burn fossil fuels and put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. We're basically performing an unprecedented chemistry experiment with the Earth's atmosphere and oceans. We have no idea what the consequences will be, but it looks so far as though they're going to be pretty, pretty bad. The other reason we have to move off of fossil fuels has to do with the fact that fossil fuels are simply depleting non-renewable resources. And I'm going to spend a few minutes sort of updating what I probably had to say 11 years ago with regard to the process of fossil fuel depletion, because this is something that I have spent a lot of time studying, and we at my organization, Post Carbon Institute, have studied very energetically. So this is kind of a schematic presentation of our situation. We extract oil, natural gas, and coal using the low-hanging fruit principle. We go after the cheapest, most readily available resources first, and leave the more expensive to extract, nastier, more polluting stuff for later. We've been doing that from the very beginning. And it's starting to be later. You know, the easy stuff is no longer readily available. And as we start at the top of the resource pyramid and move down through conventional resources, we begin to extract more unconventional resources. In the case of natural gas, that would be shale gas that we produce by hydrofracturing, horizontal drilling. With oil, it would be tight oil or deep water oil or tar sands. All of that, you know, nasty, expensive stuff, that's in the category of unconventional resources. We're not going to run out of oil or natural gas or coal. It's simply not going to happen, because at some point, it will actually cost us more energy to get the stuff out of the ground than the stuff we get out of the ground will deliver when we burn it. And in fact, most of the coal, oil, and natural gas is in that category. So when somebody says, oh, you know, we don't have to worry about fossil fuel supplies because there's, you know, untold amounts of the stuff still to extract. Well, that's true. But the question is, how much can we extract economically? Well, that's a moving target, because it depends on the price. You know, if we're willing to pay, let's say, $300, $400, $500 a barrel for oil, there's a lot of oil that we could get out of the ground that we wouldn't otherwise. But in that case, we'd be extracting oil that would have a very low energy payback in terms of the amount of energy that it would cost to get it out of the ground. Those are some of the complexities of the situation. Now let's move to some more specifics. When I was here 11 years ago, I was talking about the depletion of conventional oil and the forecasts from many very credible petroleum geologists suggesting that conventional oil production would reach a maximum and start to decline sometime over the last 10 years. And that's in fact what happened. Regular conventional oil has not been growing since 2005, 2006. Where we have seen growth in oil production, it's been in the unconventional category. So instead of simple vertical onshore wells, which are relatively cheap to drill, this is where the oil industry is going today: hydrofracturing and horizontal drilling. And globally, most of the increases in production that we have seen over the past 10 years have been in this category. And the U.S. has led the way. In North Dakota and Texas in particular, we've seen tens of thousands of new wells drilled over just these past few years. Why so many wells? Because these tight oil wells don't produce an enormous amount per well. And they also deplete and decline very rapidly. So in the very first year after drilling, the rate of production from a typical tight oil or shale gas well declines by about 65 or 70%. So if you want to maintain the overall rate of production or grow production, that means you have to drill and drill and drill. There's a drilling treadmill. I'm not going to talk tonight so much about the environmental impacts of hydrofracturing, but I do talk about it pretty extensively in my book, Snake Oil, which came out a couple of years ago. And again, this is a subject about which a lot of research has been done just in the last year or two, showing the health impact to communities, to not only to humans, but also to livestock, wildlife, and so on. But the problem with fracking is not only the environmental and health impacts, but also the fact that it's just not very economic. It's very expensive. So how is the industry managed to mobilize the drilling of tens of thousands of wells in a very short period of time? Well, it's partly because we've had a kind of unique financial environment over this last number of years. Remember, this got its start around 2007. Well, what was going on in 2007, 2008? We had an epic financial meltdown. And the response to that on the part of the Federal Reserve and US federal government was to lower interest rates practically to zero, which meant that if you have money in a savings account, it's making almost nothing. So that means that everybody wants to invest their money in stocks or bonds or something else other than savings accounts. So that's like a bubble machine. You know, that's why we have the stock market at record highs. It's not because the U.S. economy is going gangbusters. It's because, you know, basically people don't want to leave their money in a savings account, and where else can you put it? So these junk stocks and junk bonds that were put out by the fracking companies, and we're mostly not talking about big oil companies like Exxon and Chevron and BP, we're talking about much smaller to mid-size oil companies, and dozens of them. Investors were willing to put their money there, and of course these companies also needed to borrow money from banks, which they could easily do because there were low interest rates and there was lots of money to borrow. So even though the companies themselves were often losing money on actual production, they've managed to stay in business for the last number of years. But that is changing. The industry itself is changing because of the shift from regular conventional oil production to unconventional oil and gas production. The costs to the industry have been skyrocketing at a rate of almost 11% per year. And that was the main reason that oil prices shot up during the period from around 2009 to 2014, and were stuck around $100 a barrel, unprecedented high persistent oil price for a number of years. What happened was the frackers actually overproduced over the short term. It's kind of a complicated story as to why that was, but the incentive for them was to lease as much land as possible, to produce as much as they could as quickly as possible in order to show their investors that they really had the capability, that there really was the resource underground. But by doing so, they eventually drove the price of oil down well below the cost of production. So oil prices have been in the $40 to $50 range over the last year. And really, oil production in North Dakota and Texas is only profitable if oil is over $100 a barrel. So all of these companies are losing money hand over fist. Only about 1% of wells in North Dakota are profitable right now. So these folks are hanging on by their fingernails, you know, waiting for the bills to come due, waiting to see when the banks start to call in the loans. And essentially, the oil and gas industry is skating on very thin ice right now, which, of course, if you're concerned about climate change, is good news. But on the other hand, from an economic standpoint, that does have consequences. As we encounter more energy constraints as a result of all of the things I've been talking about, increased costs of production and so on, that tends to lead to higher energy prices. But high energy prices cause the economy to start to ratchet down. Demand starts to decline, and actually oil demand has not grown very much over the last 10 years because oil prices were so high. So economic contraction then leads to demand destruction, which ultimately leads to lower energy prices, which again we've seen the collapse of oil prices. And that leads to lower energy investment, which is what's happening in the oil world right now. The oil companies, whether large or small, are cutting back on upstream investments in exploration and production. So inevitably, we will see declining oil production and natural gas production over the next few years. And in fact, we're already seeing it. U.S. natural gas production, which had been going gangbusters and growing by leaps and bounds, has now leveled off and is just beginning to decline. Some of the older plays that where the fracking boom started, like the Haynesville play in Texas to Arkansas, sort of on the border of Texas and Arkansas, that's declining. The Barnett play, which was the very first shale gas play in Texas, that's declined by about half already. So the only place where shale gas production is still growing is the Marcellus region in Pennsylvania, and that looks like it's going to peak out and start to decline within the next year or two. So in oil, the Bakken formation in North Dakota is already declining. Altogether, U.S. oil production is down by about 500,000 barrels a day in the last few months. So that's going to lead to more energy constraints, and around the wheel we go, you know, and each trip around the wheel will result in more economic hardship. All of this is really an argument for moving away from fossil fuels as quickly as we can to alternative energy sources. And that's the main topic that I want to address today. And everybody who understands energy at all, everybody who understands climate change, believes and understands that this is what we have to do. This is our big job for the remainder of the 21st century. This is where the action is in the energy world. Solar and wind are the the subject of most of the conversation because that's where the growth potential lies. Now, there are other potential renewable energy sources, including hydropower and microhydro, geothermal, tidal power, wave power, and biomass. But these are all limited in one way or another, supply limited in one way or another. So most of the excitement in the energy world is about the potential for solar and wind. And at the same time, even though the fuel is free, there are some advantages of solar wind and wind. Obviously, it doesn't cost. Sunlight and wind do not themselves cost any money. The technology that we use to harvest them, of course, does cost money and requires materials and energy for construction and deployment. There are a couple of other challenges with solar and wind. These are uncontrollable intermittent energy sources. With, let's say, coal, suppose you have a coal power plant. Well, obviously that's bad news in lots of ways, but from the standpoint of the utility operator, it's pretty simple. You know, you need electricity, you just shovel in coal whenever and wherever you need it, and you've got the electricity. With solar and wind, you don't know necessarily when the wind is going to be blowing. You have a better idea of when the sun is going to be shining, although clouds are a little less predictable. But you may have, you know, days and even weeks when the wind isn't blowing very strongly. And in the winter, of course, there's less sunlight, and there can be days or sometimes even weeks of lots of cloud cover. So this is a serious problem. Also, there are environmental costs with renewable energy. Obviously, they are much smaller than is the case with fossil fuels. With coal power, for example, here in the US, we spend approximately $500 billion a year in terms of health and environmental damage from coal power. This is from a study, Harvard University, 2011. We don't pay that money up front. It doesn't all go through the one channel. It goes through our health system. It goes through environmental remediation in all kinds of ways. But that's a heck of a lot of money. It's a lot of damage. Another challenge with our renewable energy transition is that it's going to be different from our last energy transition. You know, the fossil fuel revolution was driven primarily by economic opportunity. And we were just piling new energy sources on top of existing ones. We still use firewood, maybe not as much as we did back in the 1850s, and certainly not as much on a per capita basis as we did in the 1850s, but we still use firewood. We just added hydro and coal and oil and all these things. What we're talking about doing now is replacing existing energy sources, and our main energy sources, the sources of about 80 to 83% of the energy that we're using right now. We're talking about replacing with renewable sources. So that's inherently a pretty big job. Now, on the plus side, on the advantage side, we're not going to have to replace all of that because there's an enormous amount of energy that's wasted in generating electricity from coal or natural gas. It's a very inefficient way of producing electricity. Something like 60% of the energy in the coal and natural gas is lost in the process of producing electricity. Now, that's not the case with wind and solar. These sources of energy go to electricity directly. So those losses are something that, you know, we're not going to have to produce as much energy altogether in order to produce as much electricity as we want to use. Okay, so that's on the plus side. Now, on the minus side, We don't use all of our energy in the form of electricity. I was kind of surprised, actually, when we started doing research on this, as to how little of our energy we use in the form of electricity. It's only about 22% in the United States, about 18% globally. And I should mention, by the way, that this presentation tonight is kind of a preview of a book that I'm working on, co-authored with David Fridley, who is a staff scientist in the Energy Evaluation Program of Lawrence Berkeley Labs. So when I talk about the research that we've been doing, it's not just my readings and philosophizing. It's also what David has been doing at Lawrence Berkeley Labs for the past few years. And it's been quite an eye-opener for me to have the opportunity of picking his brain on a regular basis.
That was the first part of a one-hour talk by Richard Heinberg on Our Renewable Future. He spoke on November 15, 2015, at the Willits Little Lake Grange in Northern California. Richard is Senior Fellow in Residence at the Post Carbon Institute and has written extensively on energy, economic and ecological issues, and oil depletion. He's the author of 12 books, including some of the seminal works on our energy and environmental sustainability crisis. The most recent ones are Afterburn, Society Beyond Fossil Fuels, Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future, and The End of Growth. The Post Carbon Institute was founded in 2003 to provide communities with the resources needed to understand and respond to the energy and ecological crises of the 21st century. Come back when TUC Radio returns for a fascinating discussion of energy uses that need to be ended immediately, such as coal, and how they can be replaced. For questions inherent in creating a whole new energy system, and finally, what Heinberg calls the really hard stuff, curbing, if not ending, steel and cement construction, mining, the use of plastics, and the end of airplane travel and consumerism. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.